Hello, I'm Tyson Hodson. This is number 0602, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0602. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Academy Award-winning actor George Takiris, whose memoir has just come out called My West Side Story, A Memoir. It's been 60 years since that film, but the remaining cast and crew are still very close.
The bond of a West Side Story is, in itself is an extraordinary bond. All of us, we have remained a family all these years. It's as if no time has passed in a way. Rita and I are very great friends, and some of the others in the cast, we still remain friends today. We're in touch with each other. We care about each other.
Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, is back to talk about the various missions to Mars, which involve the UAE, NASA, and the Chinese.
They have a multi-pronged approach. They have an orbiter, lander, and rover. And really all the attention is going to be on the rover, in being able to look at the chemistry of the rocks and soil, and also look at the radiation levels on the surface of the planet. We want to get a handle on how much solar radiation is reaching the surface, and that will have direct effects on how humans will be exploring the surface of Mars and being exposed to these radiation levels.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0602 was Tyson Hodgson, who is a video editor. Thank you very much, Tyson, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A woman was charged with driving under the influence after consuming whipped cream. Police said that 28-year-old Anna Thomas of Franklin, Tennessee, used cans of aerosol whipped cream to get high. She was charged with driving under the influence after crashing her car. When police arrived, Thomas was disoriented.
We should caution you. Once you get ready, you may never want to stop.
Officers found 13 cans of whipped cream scattered inside the vehicle. Almost all of the bottles were empty. No pie was discovered.
Get ready, whip, and get ready for some fun.
You do have more of this stuff, right?
No, we don't. And you need help. After her engagement ended, an Orange City, Florida woman found out her ex-fiancé was engaged again. In the photo she found on social media, his new fiancé was wearing a wedding band and engagement ring that were very similar to her own rings, so much so that she checked and discovered hers were missing along with her grandmother's diamond ring. She confronted the man, got some of the items back, called the other woman in Orlando, and then called the police. The Orlando woman said she was also missing a laptop and jewelry. The man was known to one woman as Joe Brown and Marcus Brown to the other. The Volusia County Sheriff's Office has put out a warrant for the suspected jilting lover, who is actually 48-year-old Joseph Davis. They've said he can be identified by a tattoo on his left arm that says, "Only God can judge me." Well, I'm sure there will soon be a judge who will be the judge of that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the pandemic is just that, worldwide. And worldwide, you have people who, for one reason or another, refuse to wear a mask, like a woman in South Africa who was challenged when she walked into a supermarket without a mask on. When management threatened to throw her out, she resorted to the only mask she had on her person, the one between her legs. The bizarre incident was caught on camera at the Pick and Pay supermarket, and given the story, that's an unfortunate name for the store. The shopper was asked to put on a face covering by a security guard, but she claimed she didn't have one. When she was warned that she would be refused service unless she had a mask on, she removed her thong undies and put them on her face. A video of this has since gone viral. You can clearly see the woman reach under her dress and dig around a bit. A moment later, out comes the black thong, which she deftly pulls over her head. Another female shopper appears to sarcastically congratulate her, saying, "Well done." Back in December, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa stressed that not wearing a face mask in public is a criminal offense. It is not reported whether the supermarket allowed the woman to shop with panties on her face. Remember back in the day when your mother would say, "Put on clean underwear, you never know when you might get hit by a car," which, by the way, I never understood, because if I were hit by a car, I don't know how clean my underwear would be after that. But anyway, mothers now have a new talking point in their arsenal. Wear clean underwear. You never know when you might have to wear it on your face. And by the way, you can check out said video on the Stuff File program fan page. It's there in all its glory. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Oscar-winning actor George Chakiris has just written his life story. The book is called My West Side Story, a memoir. It's been 10 years since we had him on the show, so it's an honor to have him back. George joins us on the line from California. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you? Nice to talk to you, of course.
Nice to talk to you again as well. We spoke about 10 years ago for two reasons. One was the anniversary, a big anniversary of West Side Story, and also the fact that you were, you had started a jewelry line. I was curious to know how that jewelry line is going.
Yeah, I started the jewelry thing started as a hobby, which I really loved doing, and it just developed into more than that with time, just coincidentally the way things happen. So, yes, I have a line of sterling silver jewelry that's available on the website. I have a manufacturer downtown and a manufacturer in Thailand as well. So it's a small business, and it really keeps me busy, but it's something I really enjoy.
Excellent. Well, again, I mentioned we were chatting about 10 years ago. People can go back on the website and hear the show, which is number 0116, which is back in November of 2011. So we talked a lot about West Side Story at the time. And since you're coming out with your memoir, I thought we'd go back even further, because we didn't really discuss how little George Chakiris became the singer, dancer, actor that he became. So how did that all start for you?
Well, let's see. First of all, I won't go back to where I was born. But as when I was 12 years old, my family and we all moved to California. My father had always wanted to live in California. We moved to Long Beach. It's funny the coincidental things that happened in the course of time. But the very first, my very first experience being in a movie studio, which was pretty awesome at the time. I think I was either 13 or 14. And I sang in a boys' choir at an Episcopal church in Long Beach, and they sometimes sang for movies. They did quite a few over the years. And so the choir at that time, when I was again 13 or 14, we were hired to sing in a concert sequence for a movie that's called Song of Love with Paul Henry and Katharine Hepburn and Robert Walker. So to do that, of course, we had to go. We were on the MGM lot. We had school during the day, and it was such an incredible experience, because as a kid, I grew up loving movies. That's all. I didn't know anything else, but to actually be in a movie studio was just really kind of awesome, you know. So, but my point is that I guess without realizing it, I loved that experience so much, and it was a little closer to something actually, you know, something real. But of course, nothing came with that, except that I really did love it. We met Elizabeth Taylor when she was 15 and 16 and all that, and Frank Sinatra. So it was a Mario Lanza. It was a very, very heady experience, you know. And being on that big theater stage at Metro, which I've seen in different movies, was also kind of awesome as well. So my point is, it was kind of like, it was kind of inspiring just to have that experience. And then later in school, this girl I was, we were dating, but she was a dancer. I was crazy about her. And I was her partner for a couple of the high school assemblies. And she was the one who told me about a dancing school, a very wonderful dancing school called the American School of Dance on Hollywood Boulevard, 7021 Hollywood Boulevard. I remember the address. And she said, Sid Charisse, Leslie Caron took class there. Well, that's all I needed to hear. So I took the train down from Long Beach one morning to watch a class at the American School of Dance. Nobody famous in class, but that didn't bother me. I just knew that it was something I absolutely wanted to do. So I got a job working at the May Company downtown as an office boy in the advertising department. And I worked at the May Company every day, all 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And I took classes every night. And again, everything is coincidental. So a lot of the kids that I was first meeting were already working as dancers in some of the movies. At that time, a lot of them had been working in Singing in the Rain. So I was hearing all of this stuff again. And I eventually, I got a union card. I was able to join the union and audition for some of these movie musicals as well. And I did, and I worked in the course of White Christmas, There's No Business Like Show Business, General and Preferred Blondes, and, you know, a few more. So I started from, you know, a kid, you know, just coming, getting to Long Beach for the first time, and then finally actually being on huge movie sets and watching tremendous stars, Marilyn Monroe, with so many people, and the beat kind of went on. And then in 1957, I think it was, the work for dancers in Hollywood was kind of changing, and there wasn't as much work because of television. And so I thought what I should do is go to New York, which is what I did. I bought a one-way ticket to New York, and I had some friends who had made the move before me, and they put me up on the couch in their living room. And again, just it was an extraordinary kind of circumstance, because the people who put me up on the in their living room at that time also had worked with, well, one of them was working for Roger L. Stephens, who was a huge Broadway producer, and at that time was involved and had already been involved in producing the theater version of West Side Story. That was the first time it had been done anywhere. It had been playing at the Winter Garden Theater for almost a year. They suggested I go to the Winter Garden Theater. It's amazing what the guts and the nerve that you have when you're that young. You go to the Winter Garden Theater, ask for Ruth Mitchell, who was the stage manager at that time. She later became Hal Prince's associate producer. So I went to the Winter Garden Theater at the end of a performance, and I met Ruth. And she looked at me and she said, I think you should read for Bernardo. And she set up an audition for me to audition for Jerry Robbins for the role of Bernardo. And he was rehearsing Ballets USA at the time at the Album Theater. The Album Theater now has a different name. I studied the script and, you know, prepared myself as much as I could. And I went, and it was during Jerry's lunch break, I auditioned for him and read for the role of Bernardo. After I did that, he asked me to look at the role of Ruth. So I took 20 minutes or so to go back into the wings, and with his stage manager for Ballet USA, I then read the role of Ruth. And then he asked me to learn Cool. And in the theater version, Cool is sung by Riff. In the film version, it's sung by a different character, by Tucker Smith, who played Ice, who was just amazing. He was so fantastic. So I learned Cool, and I went back and auditioned for Jerry again, to make a long story short. Sorry, this is long. And on my birthday in 1958, I got a call from Ruth Mitchell telling me I have the job of Riff in the London company of West Side Story. That was on my birthday. It was an amazing birthday. And on the same day, I had 7 checks from my California unemployment, $35 each. So for me, of course, and for quite a few of us, West Side Story was how it all, you know, the ice was broken. And I that was such an amazing opportunity. And then, you know, with time, then the film version came along, and a lot of us did screen tests for the film version as well. I did as well. I did a screen test as Riff and as Bernardo, and eventually was cast as Bernardo in the movie. That sort of really kind of brings me almost up to date. Well, that was 1950, 1960. That really is the major, the thing that made, you know, just was an incredible opportunity for me, and just a really wonderful circumstance. And that's kind of how I, you know, then after that, the marriage company who produced West Side Story signed me to a picture deal. And then so that was my first, you know, it's funny when I think about it now, I was a dancer, and suddenly I was with the marriage company and the pictures that they signed me to do. I was suddenly and amazingly starring above the title with people like Yul Brynner and Richard Widmark and Charlton Heston. It's kind of heady, but that's really what happened.
Let me ask you this: was being an actor something you always wanted to do while growing up, or was this something that came your way, like you said, when you were doing plays and dances in high school and the like? And also, was it something that your parents were excited to see you do? Were they very supportive in what you wanted to do, or was there some pushback?
No, my parents were very supportive of all of us. They thought it was great. You know, before West Side Story, the London Company, or any of that stuff, I was living in Long Beach. I wanted to go to the Pasadena Playhouse because I'd heard wonderful things about that. My parents were all for that as well. So the bottom line, my parents were wonderful supporters. They never said, why do you want to do that? You know, it'll be too... Always wonderfully supported. We were all lucky. We have really... My mother and father were just really, really extraordinary people. They were really beautiful people, good, loyal, and ethical, all of that. But they really, really were. So they were all for everything that I was thinking about and hoping to do. And they continued to be that way, of course, all through everything that happened. When I was a kid growing up and going to the movies, I didn't know that people sang and that they danced and that they act. I didn't know any of that. I have never been to a theater to see a play or anything like that. So there was nothing in my background that I could learn from. Dancers, pretty much, we think of and going from really from job to job. But when jobs, different jobs come up, you find a way, even though you find a way to deal with it and to work with it. So it was through having those experiences that I became aware that, you know, some people acted, some people danced, some people sang, and some people did all of it. But my first work as an actor was really playing Riff in the London Company of West Side. One of the things I can say, I think, about West Side Story, the theater version, I've seen quite a few theater versions over the years with, you know, young people involved in that, and there is something about West Side Story, that material, that engages young people in a way like nothing else. When you're working on West Side Story, it really pulls you in a way that nothing else does. You come involved, you care about it really deeply, and that's the thing that happened to me as well. So I became very, very quickly aware that I had always been, you know, going back to being a choir member, the boys' choir in Long Beach. As a kid, of course, my voice had not changed, and I still had a soprano voice. But I somehow, because I could hear myself sing, and so I kind of felt kind of confident that I had a good voice. And when my voice changed, I continued to have a good voice. So singing was not anything new for me. I somehow sort of, not egotistically, but anything, but I could hear myself sing, and I felt confident about my singing voice. The thing that I did not know anything about was, of course, working as an actor, but working with Jerry Robbins for the role of Riff in the London Company of West Side Story, working with Jerry Robbins really, really pulled you into and made you, not didn't make you learn, you couldn't help but learn from him. And you learned how to work on a character for Riff for West Side Story. But again, it's such an extraordinary piece. It really, you don't stop to think, you don't that you're learning anything. You just simply do what you're called on to do. So my work as an actor really started with West Side Story, playing Riff in London. And then I guess I can say, I don't want to sound too egotistical here, but there was something about acting that I will say come naturally to me as well. The thing that's important in all areas, whether it's dance, music, singing, or acting, is the material. Everybody, no matter who they are and whatever stage of their careers they are in, everybody always is in search of good material, particularly for actors. And material makes a huge difference in what you're able finally to do as an actor. Some pieces, and I keep going back to West Side Story, because it was such a deep commitment, and you felt it so deep, and you cared so much about it, it helped you through that learning process, and it helped you in creating a character.
We are talking with Oscar-winning actor George Chakiris, who has written his memoir. The book is called My West Side Story, A Memoir. And we'll take a quick break. We'll continue talking to George on the other side. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Don't go away.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And The Stuff File program is heard everywhere for all your devices on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can also find it on several fine radio stations such as WLSL-LP-FM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories. And thanks to all for joining in. Don't touch that dial. We continue our chat with Oscar-winning actor George Chakiris. He has just written his life story. The book is called My West Side Story, A Memoir. One of the things I wanted to talk about, George, is your connection with your co-Academy Award winner. And of course, we're talking about Rita Moreno. Rita has written a blurb for your book, and I'll read the blurb here. It says, "You will savor this story of a Greek boy in America who did well. Very well indeed." You got the Oscar the same night, obviously, that Rita got the Oscar. You two have been joined.
Yeah, we were right there together.
Yeah, you two have been joined at the hip. And I guess considering this blurb, that connection still remains.
Absolutely. We're still as close as we ever were. And we have the bond of West Side Story is in itself is an extraordinary bond. All of us, we have remained a family all these years. It's as if no time has passed in a way. Rita and I are very great friends, and some of the others in the cast, we still remain friends today. We're in touch with each other. We care about each other. And by the way, Bob Wise, who co-directed West Side Story with Jerry Robbins, I think West Side Story was very special for Bob as well. I think it's worth telling this just so it might be helpful. After the filming of West Side Story, the girls especially always kept in touch with Bob and would invite him to lunch maybe two or three times a year. And that continued up until the time that we lost Bob. My point being that even Bob said in no other movie that he made, did he have the ongoing experience with the cast the way he did with West Side Story. So again, I'm getting back to West Side Story and the unique experience that that created artistically and everything among with everyone who worked on it.
Let me ask you this, because there is a brand new a remake of West Side Story done by Steven Spielberg, and I know that Rita is actually attached to it. She's one of the producers. Are you attached to the new West Side Story?
It was scheduled to premiere last December, and because of COVID, of course, that didn't happen. My understanding is it's now scheduled to premiere in December of this year. The one thing that I kind of feel I'd like to say about that, Steven Spielberg is an extraordinary filmmaker, and I'm sure he's going to do something really wonderful. He always does. But the thing that I feel almost obligated to mention, and with all due respect, is that he did not create West Side Story. It was all there many years before, and in an extraordinary sense, but with all the work, so much of the work and all the work done, it was there. It was a finished piece. So I wonder, and I'm not sure, if West Side Story had never been done, would Steven Spielberg be doing it? Or anybody be doing it? No, I think it's the piece itself that people, and he obviously must have fallen in love with in some way as well. But again, the main thing I feel obligated to say, out of respect to Jerry Robbins, Bob Wise, Arthur Lawrence, Stephen, all of the people who originated West Side Story, that template was something that any filmmaker could take and work with if they wanted to. But the work was done. That doesn't mean there isn't more work to do. You can think about things and fine-tune them or whatever. But the bottom line is, it was created by, first of all, Jerome Robbins, Arthur Lawrence, Leonard Bernstein, and Stephen Sondheim for the theater. And it existed that way up until, 2 years ago, and still exists that way. And, of course, the film version, again, I basically am just saying that with all due respect, I think it's important to remember the originators of the piece and all the work that was done by them, to even get it off the ground.
Are you connected in any way, shape, or form with the new production, the film?
Oh, no. I never crossed my mind, quite honestly. I didn't. That couldn't happen for me. I think it makes great sense for Rita to do it, and the role that she's playing, basically, my understanding, is taking over the role of Doc, who runs the drugstore.
Yes.
So she.
Yes.
It's later in life. There was nothing that I could be right for. And also, one of the things I think Steven Spielberg is making a real issue of, and that is for all the Hispanic roles, he has insisted on using Hispanic kids. I don't think he has a single Puerto Rican, but they're all Hispanic. They're playing Hispanic parts. And I understand that kind of, today's world, that's the way you want to cast things. At the same time, I think of a Steven Spielberg movie called Schindler's List, in which the two main characters, Jewish characters, were not played by Jewish actors. So no one's perfect in this casting department, but I know that something that was, I think from what I've heard, that it was an important aspect of the way he felt he wanted to cast his version.
With the upcoming West Side Story, people are saying that, with Steven Spielberg directing a musical, maybe it will help in the resurgence of musicals, a form of entertainment that we haven't seen as much as we used to back in the day. Would you like to see more movie musicals made?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are so many people who really love that genre and would love to be able to be creating in that way. But I my understanding is only as the layman, which is all I can call myself, is that movie musicals evidently are more expensive to produce. And also, I think one of the worries is having an audience. So I think and hope and expect, in a way, that with Steven Spielberg, because he is who he is, he's extraordinary, his version of West Side Story hopefully will open the door to more people being able to do what they'd like to do in musical film. That would be just tremendous for so many people.
The recent pandemic we're all going through right now, was what shut down Broadway and also the current revival of West Side Story that was on the boards. Did you have an opportunity to see the new version of West Side Story, which was rather avant-garde? It also used a lot of video in addition to the actors on stage. Did you have a chance to see it?
No, I didn't have a chance to see it. Because of COVID, nothing lasted very long. I didn't get it, but I saw, I suppose, aspects of it on the computer, online. And it really was a departure, so to speak, because of the video aspect and the things being projected on big screens and so on. I thought I would love to have been able to see it, but I didn't. I'm on the West Coast, and I never got to New York in time to see it, although I really would love to have seen it.
Your book, as I mentioned, is called My West Side Story, a Memoir. And again, we chatted 10 years ago when it was the 50th anniversary of West Side Story. Why is it you waited till now to do your memoir as opposed to doing it earlier?
Well, I guess the answer, I just never thought of it, quite honestly. This book came about, first of all, with interest from the publisher first, with a writer attached, a wonderful writer called Lindsay Harrison. She did Tippi Hedren's book. She's done some really wonderful books. And it sort of came to my attention and sort of fell into my lap that way. So with the offer, quote unquote, to do a book, of course, then I thought about, should I do this? I wondered, to be perfectly honest. But then I sat with Lindsay Harrison, the writer, and we did write a book. But it came, and the title, by the way, was suggested by the publishers as well. I think I like the title, but credit where credit is due. It wasn't my thought. I think that was the reason that the publishers were interested in doing a book to begin with. I don't want to sound stupidly humble, but I've never thought of myself as important enough to write a book anyway. But when it happened, I couldn't help but be interested in doing that.
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding stupidly humble, as you say, when one goes through an entire career, you kind of have your head down and you do the job you have to do whatever it is you're doing. But when you sit down and write a memoir, you get an opportunity to reflect on some of the things you did and realize what some of those successes were, even against the challenges. I'm just curious to know if in the process of writing this book, you got a new appreciation for the journey you have been on through your life and career.
Absolutely. You know, because it was a while ago, so there's a lot of thought reflection in the course of revisiting all of this stuff. Absolutely. There's first of all, one of the things that I think I mentioned in the book was the first movie that I worked on after West Side Story. You know, suddenly there I was, my name above the title with Richard Widmark and Yul Brynner. I mean, that must have been a pretty heady experience. I don't think it really sunk into me, but in writing the book, I realized that was a real challenge. Is not really the right word, but that was such a different experience for me from anything, from being just a dancer in the chorus, or even being in West Side Story, which I knew inside out because I did it for a year and a half in London. So it wasn't a strange or off the wall kind of experience. I knew every character so well because I did the show for that long. But I'm thinking of this movie that with Richard Widmark and Yul Brynner called Flight from a Shia, and I mentioned this in the book. We all play air rescue mission pilots, and I did a lot of quite a few scenes with Richard Widmark in the mock-up of a helicopter. And, you know, I'd been in the theater, and I knew what it was like to work. You know, you work with your props and all that I saw. But sitting with Richard Widmark in the studio, he did absolutely what he was supposed to do. He checked all the controls and everything and see how he could incorporate that into playing that scene. I think I was too nervous, but didn't know it, to be responsible and be a responsible actor and use the set that I have around me or the props and so on. And it was writing this book and remembering how I felt that I that the responsibility of, you know, playing a leading role in a movie with your name above the title and all that stuff, you know, was probably more worrying to me than I even knew at the time. But so when you revisit it and you try to remember how all of that felt, it was what I managed to do it, but it was new. Mm. It was new to me, and being an important person in the casting of a film. One of the things that I'm, you know, no matter where I am or who I'm around, or even with all the West Side Story group, whenever we're all together, I'm pretty much the quiet person in the room, you know, and I don't draw attention to myself. I don't try to, and I don't even think of it. In fact, I think I'm more comfortable if I don't draw attention to myself. And by the way, that's another thing with the book. I thought, I'm drawing attention to myself. So I really want to do this. Obviously, the answer was ultimately was yes, because we did it.
Well, let me ask you this question then, because we often talk about George Takiris, the night you won the Academy Award, standing next to Rita Moreno. In Hollywood, what was the difference from your perspective of George Takiris the day before the Oscars and the day before the win and the day after George Takiris, Oscar winner? How did your life in Hollywood change because of that Oscar?
Well, it changed in the opportunities that continued to come my way. But I, to be honest about myself, I just didn't understand it, or sort of quote unquote get it myself, that there was a change, that winning an Oscar, you know, put me in a different position, in a position of being able to make decisions or accept or not accept things that came my way. But I've never been someone who thought with an arc, so to speak, of a career and making career moves, so to speak, based on if you finish something, okay, now what would I like to do next? I never thought that way. I'm not happy about that. I didn't think that way, because I think it would have been better for me if I had. But I just continued to think, I'm thinking of it now, I was talking to you, but at the time I knew something wonderful had happened. But I didn't know how to apply it to work or a career, or that I was, in fact, in a better position, so to speak. I knew I was, but at the same time, I didn't know.
Well, congratulations on writing your memoir. The book, again, is called My West Side Story, A Memoir by George Takiris. And I thank you very, very much, George, for taking the time to be on the program with us once again.
Hey, thank you so much. And thanks for reminding me. We did this 10 years ago. it's my pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. Thank you.
Academy Award-winning actor George Takiris. His book is My West Side Story, A Memoir. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0602, and you'll find the link to George's site, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. And for those of you who want to hear our previous conversation from way back in November of 2011, you can again go to the website at thestufffile.com and check out the link to show number 0116. That's 0116 to hear our first chat with George Takiris. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, I've worked at radio stations where we would take a break for traffic and weather together, so let's do that. In weather, the high today on the red planet is minus 25 degrees Celsius. Tonight's low is minus 82 degrees Celsius. As for traffic, it's starting to look like gridlock on Mars these days. You have NASA, you have the Chinese, and you have the United Arab Emirates. What's with all the traffic?
Everybody has their eyes on Mars now. Some of these missions that we're seeing, like from China and United Arab Emirates, are really a proof of their technological prowess for the nation. It represents the pride of these nations, of abilities to really enter into this very elite club of Mars exploration. And of course, there's NASA with the Perseverance rover, which is really pushing the boundaries in terms of hardcore science and engineering that is representing a stepping stone in eventually having humans explore Mars.
Okay, so we saw recently all the excitement with Perseverance when it landed on the red planet. It also contains a helicopter, which is an interesting point we'll get to in a moment. But on the surface, pardon the pun, how different are these three different missions from three different countries?
If we look at first at the United Arab Emirates and its orbiter, HOPE, the mission there is really twofold. First off, we have to remember that this is an orbiter, so it does not land ever on the surface. It's completely just always circling the planet. So it basically has kind of like an eagle-eyed view of large areas, regions, and global and a global perspective of Mars, and it's looking very much focused on the atmosphere of the planet. You have to remember the planet's atmosphere is made of carbon dioxide. It's 1% as thick as Earth's, and yet with being so feeble, it still is very dynamic, and there's weather patterns that are occur on a daily basis, but there's also a lot of climate data points that are very interesting. We're talking about long-term climate of Mars reaching back over a billion years, even more, that we don't even understand yet. I mean, we really have only pieces of this puzzle of what's happened to Mars. And what HOPE, the orbiter from the United Arab Emirates, is doing is trying to piece together the idea of what happened to Mars's climate and atmosphere. We think over a billion years ago, Mars was warm and wet, and it had a very thick atmosphere. So it was very much like Earth, with even large bodies of water on its surface. And something happened along the way that made it into a dry, barren world. And we think the answer is in the atmosphere. So for some reason, the atmosphere got stripped away. And so Orbiter is really looking at that fundamental science of the climate.
So that takes care of what the United Arab Emirates are doing. What is the Chinese mission?
With China, they have a multi-pronged approach. They have an orbiter, lander, and rover. And really all the attention is going to be on the rover in being able to look at the chemistry of the rocks and soil, understand the fundamental chemical fingerprints there, and also look at the radiation levels on the surface of the planet. And that's really interesting because we want to get a handle on how much solar radiation is reaching the surface, and that will have direct effects on how humans will be exploring the surface of Mars and being exposed to these radiation levels that we know exists on the surface.
Since both NASA and the Chinese have landers, how far are they apart where they are on Mars?
They're really exploring very different areas. The Chinese lander is really in an area in a large desert-like region, which is very close to where the old Viking landers landed in 1976. In contrast, where Perseverance is located, in a very rugged terrain at the basin of a 25-kilometer-wide basin, basically, of a large crater called Jezero, just north of the equator. Both of them are in the northern hemisphere, but they're separated in, basically by thousands of miles. And each one is really specialized into being able to dig into the surrounding terrain. The Chinese one is really looking more as to play it safe in the way, in its abilities to traverse the terrain. It's a much more safer terrain. Perseverance is really geared to go off-roading in a big way. So you're going to see a lot more chances being taken with the Perseverance rover.
We'll get to the helicopter in a moment with the NASA one, but I know that the U.S. one is going to be collecting some rocks to eventually bring them back from Mars to Earth to study. So having said that, before we get into the details of what the NASA mission is there anything the Chinese is doing right now that NASA hasn't done before with any of the previous missions they've had to Mars?
Not very much, but I think the one that a lot of people are going to be looking at, and I know NASA is looking at, is that data on the amount of radiation on the surface of Mars. This is something that still most of us don't much of a risk this kind of radiation could pose for future astronauts who are living and working for extended periods of time on the surface. So I think NASA will be looking at that kind of data. The question is, will Chinese release that data? They're very secretive.
Between the Chinese and NASA, which one do you think will find Matt Damon first?
Well, my vote's on Perseverance. Okay. Percy's going to be able to visit a lot of different places.
Well, plus they've got that helicopter. So let's talk about that. How unique is this? Yeah. The idea that they have to create a flying ship, a helicopter, that has to deal with the atmosphere that Mars has, which, of course, is totally different than ours.
Well, that's it. I mean, the biggest obstacle here is how thin the atmosphere is. It's 1% as thick as Earth's. And so the idea to have lift for a vehicle, even though it's a small drone that we're talking about, the idea is to can it fly? You know, and that's the big thing. And if it can, I mean, this will be a huge milestone. It'll be the first time we'll have a powered flight on another planet. And it's kind of neat because this little vehicle, flying vehicle, is equipped with cameras on board. So we should be able to get a completely unique perspective on Mars like we've never had before once it takes flight.
When you say small drone, just how small? What can you compare it to?
You know, if you look at back on Earth during its test flights and before it was fixed to the underbelly of the rover, this, I would say it's as big as a large drone that you would get. A lot of real estate people use these kind of similar size drones to we see, you know, aerial footage of real estate. That's pretty much very similar. It's a much more stripped down version, however. It's not as robust. And they had to keep it very as light as possible. And you have to keep in mind, this is a demonstration, a sort of a technology proof of concept to see if it works. If it does, and by the way, they have about 5 flights that they hope to do, starting in a series of flights over 30 days. They're hoping to do it. We should see it in the next few months doing this. Throughout maybe March, April, May, we'll see those flights. And If each one is a success, the last two are expected to take it quite far away from the rover, which will be really interesting.
We saw the simulation of the rover being dropped onto Mars, and then the craft that dropped it on Mars took off again. Where did that go?
Yeah, so you had basically the powered flight, the descent module that where you saw the rover being lowered on tethers, nylon tethers. That descent module actively with the active power jets went off to a safe distance on autopilot and crash landed. And they're actually now actively looking for the crash landed site through orbital photos.
And so, as I said, they're hoping to gather some of the Martian soil and bring it back. So that's another mission, I believe, 2 years in the future that will go to get what Percy has found and bring it back?
Yeah, I mean, so the main goal of this mission is really to search for evidence of past life, ancient life. We know from Curiosity Rover, the older sister of Perseverance, that Mars had habitable environment in the past. Where it's landed, we feel that it's in the prime position to gather samples, which we'll stow on board in little capsules in the first 2 years of its mission. And the idea is that 2 to 4 years from now, in a joint mission with the European Space Agency, NASA will send a follow-up rover mission that will collect these samples of Perseverance and then bring them back, basically rocket them off of the surface of Mars and bring those capsules back to Earth labs.
So in other words, they're just going to pick up the soil that Percy collects. They're not bringing Percy back at the same time?
Exactly. So Perseverance is just going to be staying there for the rest of its life. But those samples will be collected and brought back. So that's going to be really exciting. We'll get the final, we'll get a good, I think, grasp of the possibility of life. I mean, they're going to be picking very carefully those samples, the ones that they feel have the best chance of giving us a clear indication of life. But the final word will probably have to wait until they come back to Earth labs.
And what is the expected life expectancy of Percy?
Well, it's designed, the mission, all the goals to be accomplished and objectives in the next 2 years. However, I think what will be interesting is that because of how Curiosity's been going on for 7 years now, I think we have a lot more in store than 2 years with Perseverance. So we got a lot of interesting signs to come.
Well, interesting indeed. Thank you once again, Andrew, for Martian traffic and weather together.
You bet. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0602, and you'll find links to his site and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We do have an idiot of the day coming up in just a matter of moments, but I got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. Mr. Friendly Auto Service in Warren, Michigan is one of two auto repair businesses in the area targeted by a serial pooper. The man, seen on surveillance video, entered parked, unlocked vehicles to do his business, leaving his deposits behind for the workers to find the next day. The man first struck in November and returned in January. In February, police said the man struck at nearby Twin Tire, going from car to car until he found one left unlocked because of an electrical problem, said Chris Phillips, manager of Mr. Friendly. Now we've got double padlocks on the gate. The guy needs to be caught. There is something wrong with him. Well, for one thing, perhaps his diet. I'd be curious to find out, when he's eventually caught, what road trips must have been like with his parents when he was a kid. Okay, I know we always herald in the idiot of the day at the end of the program each week, but sometimes we occasionally come across a person who is just plain stupid. Like, duh, stupid. Case in point, An unidentified Dunkin' Donuts customer was captured on video berating store employees on February 15th and demanding that she get 50 Munchkin Donuts after ordering a dozen. "I need more," she forcefully told the clerk. 50, 50. That's what a dozen is." Another customer tried to correct her, saying, "A 12 is a dozen," to which the woman replied, "I want more than 12. I want 50. And later continued, "You understand nothing. You're not understanding the English or the math." Wow. I have no words for that. That's just plain stupid. What I can say is, coming up right now is the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
19-year-old Brandon Sewells was arrested by police in Coolidge, Arizona on February 17th for falsely reporting to police that he had been kidnapped in an apparent scheme to get out of work. A week earlier, police found Sewells lying near a water tower with his hands bound behind his back and a bandana in his mouth. Sewells told officers two men had kidnapped him from his home, knocked him unconscious, and driven him around in his car looking for money his father had hidden around town. But detectives could find no evidence of a kidnapping or assault, and when pressed, Sewells confessed he made the story up to avoid work at the tire factory store, which subsequently fired him. Now, I've posted a picture of him on the Stuff File Facebook fan page, which shows him tied up in the dirt, which means that police would have had to have taken a picture of him when he was found before they, and I'm doing air quotes, rescued him. This leads me to believe that the cops didn't really find his story credible from the get-go. I'm sure they had a good laugh. Because why? Oh, why? Would you go to all the trouble of trying to tie your own hands behind your back after you shoved a bandana in your mouth to fake a kidnapping just to get out of work when the easy thing to do would be, you know, just call in sick? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0602. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0602. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, Verdant Square Radio, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CKHR in Hay River. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep question to ponder. Who did we compare babies to before Winston Churchill?